saw that he was too close to spear him a cop, he wheeled that horse around, and he rode off a bit. And did him a quick round about face and charged him again. Out for blood, man. Only this time, the cops got tired of that bullshit, and one of them started shooting. And that was the lick. Old Rice didn't have time to get his gum, so he let fly that spear, and you could hear him grunt and say something about the cops' kinfolks, and then him and that horse shot up the street, leaping like hi-ho to goddamn silver. Man, where'd you come from? It's the truth, man. Here's my right hand. They were laughing outside the hedge and leaving, and I lay in a cramp, wanting to laugh, and yet knowing that Ross was not funny. Or not only funny, but dangerous as well. Wrong, but justified. Crazy, and yet coldly sane. Why do they make it seem funny? Only funny, I thought. And yet, knowing that it was. It was funny. And dangerous. And sad. Jack had seen it, or had stumbled upon it, and used it to prepare a sacrifice. And I had been used as a tool. Oh, my grandfather had been wrong about yesing them to death and destruction. Or else, things had changed too much since his day. There was only one way to destroy them. I got it from behind the hedge in the waning moon, wet and shaken in the hot air, and started out looking for Jack, still turned around in my direction. I moved into the street listening to the distant sounds of the ride and seeing in my mind the image of two eyes in the bottom of a shattered glass. I kept to the darker side of the streets and to the silent areas, thinking that if he wished really to hide his strategy, he'd appear in the district, with a sound truck, perhaps, playing the friendly advisor with Restrum and Tobit beside him. They were in civilian clothes, and I thought, cops. Until I saw the baseball bat and started to turn, hearing, "Hey, you!" I hesitated. "What's in a briefcase?" they said, and if they'd asked me anything else, I might have stood still. But at the question, a wave of shame and outrage shook me, and I ran, still heading for Jack. But I was in a strange territory now, and someone, for some reason, had removed the manhole cover, and I felt myself plunge down, down, a long drop that ended upon a load of coal that sent up a cloud of dust, and I lay in the black dark upon the black coal, no longer running, hiding or concerned, hearing the shifting of the coal as from somewhere above their voices came floating down. "You see the way he went down? Zoom! I was just fixing to slug the bastard. You hit him? I don't know. Say, Joe, you think the bastard's dead? Maybe. He's sure in the dark, though. You can't even see his eyes. Nigga in the coal pile, eh, Joe?" someone hollered down the hole. "Hey, black boy, come on out. We want to see what's in that briefcase." "Come down and get me," I said. "What's in that briefcase?" "You," I said, suddenly laughing. "What do you think of that?" "Me? All of you," I said. "You're crazy," he said. "But I still have you in the briefcase." "What'd you steal?" "Can you see?" I said. "Light a match." "What the hell's he talking about, Joe?" "Strike a match. The boogie's nuts." High above, I saw the small flames sputter into light. They stood, heads down, as in prayer, unable to see me back in the coal. "Come on down," I said. "I've had you in my briefcase all the time, and you didn't know me then, and you can't see me now." "You son of a bitch," one of them called, outrage. Then the match went out, and I heard something fall softly upon the coal nearby. They were talking above. "You goddamn black nigger son of a bitch," someone called. "See how you like this?" And I heard the cover settle over the manhole with a dull clang. Fine bits of dirt showered down as they stamped upon the lid, and for a moment I sent Cole sliding in wild surprise, looking up through the black space to where for a second the dim light of a match sank through a circle of holes in the steel. Then I thought, this is the way it's always been. Only now I know it. And rested back, calm now, placing the briefcase beneath my head. I could open it in the morning, push off the lid. Now I was tired, too tired, my mind retreating, the image of the two glass eyes running together like blobs of melting lead. Here it was, as though the riot was gone, and I felt the tug of sleep seem to move out upon black water. It's a kind of death without hanging, I thought. A death alive.
In the morning, I'll remove the lid. Mary. I should have gone to Mary's. I would go now to Mary's, in the only way that I could. I moved off over the black water, floating, sighing, sleeping invisibly. But I was never to reach Mary's, and I was over-optimistic about removing the steel cap in the morning. Great invisible waves of time flowed over me, but that morning never came. There was no morning nor light of any kind to awaken me, and I slept on and on until finally I was aroused by hunger. Then I was up in the dark and blundering around, feeling rough walls and the cold giving way beneath each step like treacherous sand. I tried to reach above me, but found only space, unbroken and impenetrable. Then I tried to find the usual ladder that leads out of such holes, but there was none. I had to have a light, and now on hands and knees, holding tight to my briefcase, I searched the coal until I found the folder of matches the men had dropped. How long ago had that been? But there were only three, and to save them I started searching for paper to make a torch, feeling about slowly over the coal pile. I needed just one piece of paper to light my way out of the hole, but there was nothing. Next, I searched my pockets, finding not even a bill or an advertising folder or a Brotherhood leaflet. Why had I destroyed Reinhardt's throwaway? Well, there was only one thing to do if I was to make a torch. I'd have to open my briefcase. In it were the only papers I had. I started with my high school diploma, applying one precious match with a feeling of remote irony, even smiling, as I saw the swift but feeble light push back the gloom. I was in a deep basement, full of shapeless objects that extended farther than I could see. And I realized that to light my way out, I would have to burn every paper in the briefcase. I moved slowly off toward the darker blackness, lighting my way by these feeble torches. The next to go was Clifton's doll, but it burned so stubbornly that I reached inside the case for something else. Then, by the light of the smoke-sputtering doll, I opened a folded page. It was the anonymous letter, which burned so quickly that as it flamed, I hurriedly unfolded another. It was that slip upon which Jack had written my Brotherhood name. I could still smell Emma's perfume even in the dampness of the cellar. And now, seeing the handwriting of the two in the consuming flames, I burned my hand and slipped to my knees, staring. The handwriting was the same. Ha! I knelt there, stunned, watching the flames consume them. That he, or anyone at that late date, could have named me and set me running with one and the same stroke of the pen was too much. Suddenly I began to scream, getting up in the darkness and plunging wildly about, bumping against walls, scattering coal, and in my anger extinguishing my feeble light. But still whirling on in the blackness, knocking against the rough walls of a narrow passage, banging my head and cursing, I stumbled down and plunged against some kind of partition and sailed headlong, coughing and sneezing into another dimensionless room, where I continued to roll about on the floor in my outrage. How long this kept up, I do not know. It might have been days, weeks. I lost all sense of time. And every time I paused to rest, the outrage revived and I went off again. Then finally, when I could barely move, something seemed to say, "That's enough, don't kill yourself. You've run enough. You're through with them." Ha! At last. And I collapsed, face forward, and lay there beyond the point of exhaustion, too tired to close my eyes. It was a state neither of dreaming nor of waking, but somewhere in between, in which I was caught like True Blood's jaybird that Yellow Jackets had paralyzed in every part but his eyes. But somehow the floor had now turned to sand, and the darkness to light, and I lay the prisoner of a group consisting of Jack and old Emerson and Bledsoe and Norton and Ross and the school superintendent and a number of others whom I failed to recognize, but all of whom had run me, who now pressed around me as I lay beside a river of black water, near where an armored bridge arched sharply away to where I could not see. And I was protesting their holding me, and they were demanding that I return to them and were annoyed with my refusal. No, I said, I'm through with all your illusions and lies. I'm through running.
Not quite, Jack said above the other's angry demands. But you soon will be, unless you return.
Refuse and we'll free you of your illusions, all right.
No, thank you. I'll free myself, I said, struggling to rise from the cutting sand. But now they came forward with a knife, holding me. And I felt the bright red pain, and they took the two bloody blobs and cast them over the bridge. And out of my anguish I saw them curve up and catch beneath the apex of the curving arch of the bridge to hang there, dripping down through the sunlight into the dark red water. And while the others laughed, before my pain-sharpened eyes, the whole world was slowly turning red.
Now you're free of illusions, Jack said, pointing to my seed wasting upon the air. How does it feel to be free of one's illusions?
And I looked up through a pain so intense now that the air seemed to roar with the clanging of metal hearing.
How does it feel to be free of illusion?
And now I answered, painful and empty, as I saw a glittering butterfly circle three times around my blood-red parts up there beneath the bridge's high arch. But look, I said, pointing. And they looked and laughed. And suddenly seeing their satisfied faces and understanding, I gave a Bledsoe laugh, startling them. And Jack came forward, curious.
Why do you laugh? He said.
Because at a price I now see that which I couldn't see, I said. What does he think he sees, they said. And Jack came closer, threatening, and I laughed. I'm not afraid now, I said, but if you'll look, you'll see it's not invisible.
See what, they said, that there hang not only my generations wasting upon the water,
and now the pain welled up and I could no longer see them.
But what? Go on, they said, but your sun, yes, and your moon, he's crazy, your world.
I knew he was a mystic idealist, Tobit said.
Still, I said, there's your universe. And that drip-drop upon the water you hear is all the history you've made, all you're going to make. Now, laugh, you scientists. Let's hear you laugh. And high above me now, the bridge seemed to move off to where I could not see, striding like a robot, an iron man whose iron legs clanged doomfully as it moved. And then I struggled up, full of sorrow and pain, shouting,
No! No! We must stop him!
And I awoke in the blackness. Fully awake now, I simply lay there as though paralyzed. I could think of nothing else to do. Later I would try to find my way out, but now I could only lie on the floor, reliving the dream. All their faces were so vivid that they seemed to stand before me beneath a spotlight. They were all up there somewhere, making a mess of the world. Well, let them. I was through, and in spite of the dream, I was whole. And now I realized that I couldn't return to Mary's, or to any part of my old life. I could approach it only from the outside. And I had been as invisible to Mary as I had been to the Brotherhood. No, I couldn't return to Mary's or to the campus or to the Brotherhood or home. I could only move ahead or stay here, underground. So, I would stay here until I was chased out. Here, at least, I could try to think things out in peace or, if not in peace, in quiet. I would take up residence underground. The end was in the beginning. So there you have all of it that's important. Or at least you almost have it. I'm an invisible man and it placed me in a hole. Or showed me the hole I was in, if you will. And I reluctantly accepted the fact. What else could I have done? Once you get used to it, reality is as irresistible as a club, and I was clubbed into the cellar before I caught the hint.
Perhaps that's the way it had to be. I don't know. Nor do I know whether accepting the lesson has placed me in the rear or in the avant-garde. That, perhaps, is a lesson for history. And I'll leave such decisions to Jack and his ilk while I try belatedly to study the lesson of my own life. Let me be honest with you. A feat which, by the way, I find of the utmost difficulty. When one is invisible, he finds such problems as good and evil, honesty and dishonesty, of such shifting shapes that he confuses one with the other, depending upon who happens to be looking through him at the time. Well, now I've been trying to look through myself, and there's a risk in it. I was never more hated than when I tried to be honest, or when, even as just now, I've tried to articulate exactly what I felt to be the truth. No one was satisfied, not even I. On the other hand, I've never been more loved and appreciated than when I tried to justify and affirm someone's mistaken beliefs, or when I've tried to give my friends the incorrect, absurd answers they wished to hear. In my presence, they could talk and agree with themselves. The world was nailed down, and they loved it. They received a feeling of security. But here was the rub. Too often, in order to justify them, I had to take myself by the throat and choke myself until my eyes bulged and my tongue hung out and wagged like the door of an empty house in a high wind. Oh, yes. It made them happy, and it made me sick. So I became ill of affirmation, of saying yes against the naysaying of my stomach, not to mention my brain. There is, by the way, an area in which a man's feelings are more rational than his mind, and it is precisely in that area that his will is pulled in several directions at the same time. You might sneer at this, but I know now. I was pulled this way and that for longer than I can remember, and my problem was that I always tried to go in everyone's way but my own. I've always been called one thing and then another while no one really wished to hear what I called myself. So after years of trying to adopt the opinions of others, I finally rebelled. I am an invisible man. Thus I have come a long way and returned and boomeranged a long way from the point in society toward which I originally aspired. So I took to the cellar. I hibernated. I got away from it all. But that wasn't enough. I couldn't be still even in hibernation because, damn it, there's the mind. The mind wouldn't let me rest. Gin, jazz, and dreams were not enough. Books were not enough. My belated appreciation of the crude joke that had kept me running was not enough. And my mind revolved again and again back to my grandfather. And despite the farce that ended my attempt to say yes to brotherhood, I'm still plagued by his deathbed advice. Perhaps he hid his meaning deeper than I thought. Perhaps his anger threw me off. I can't decide. Could he have meant, hell, he must have meant the principle. That we were to affirm the principle on which the country was built and not the men, or at least not the men who did the violence. Did he mean say yes because he knew that the principle was greater than the men, greater than the numbers and the vicious power and all the methods used to corrupt its name? Did he mean to affirm the principle which they themselves had dreamed into being out of the chaos and darkness of the feudal past, and which they had violated and compromised to the point of absurdity even in their own corrupt minds? Or did he mean that we had to take responsibility for all of it, for the men as well as the principal, because we were the heirs who must use the principal because no other fitted our needs, not for the power or the vindication, but because we, with the given circumstance of our origin, could only thus find transcendence? Was it that we most of all, had to affirm the principle, the plan in whose name we had been brutalized and sacrificed, not because we would always be weak or because we were afraid or opportunistic, but because we were older than they,
in the sense of what it took to live in the world with others, and because they had exhausted in us some, not much, but some, of the human greed and smallness, yes, and the fear and superstition that had kept them running. Oh, yes, they were running too, running all over themselves. Or was it, did he mean that we should affirm the principle because we, through no fault of our own, were linked to all the others in the loud, clamoring, semi-visible world, that world seen only as a fertile field for exploitation by Jack and his kind, and with condescension by Norton and his, who were tired of being the mere pawns in the futile game of making history? Had he seen that for these two, we had to say yes to the principle, lest they turn upon us to destroy both it and us? Agree 'em to death and destruction, Grandfather had advised. Hell, weren't they their own death and their own destruction, except as the principle lived in them and in us? And here's the cream of the joke. Weren't we part of them as well as apart from them, and subject to die when they died? Ah, I can't figure it out. It escapes me. But what do I really want, I've asked myself. Certainly not the freedom of a Reinhardt or the power of a Jack, nor simply the freedom not to run. No, but the next step I couldn't make, so I've remained in the hole. I'm not blaming anyone for this state of affairs, mind you, nor merely crying mea culpa. The fact is that you carry part of your sickness within you, at least I do as an invisible man. I carried my sickness, and though for a long time I tried to place it in the outside world, the attempt to write it down shows me that at least half of it lay within me. It came upon me slowly, like the strange disease that affects those black men whom you see turning slowly from black to albino, their pigment disappearing as under the radiation of some cruel, invisible ray. You go along for years knowing something is wrong, then suddenly you discover that you're as transparent as air. At first you tell yourself that it's all a dirty joke, or that it's due to the political situation. But deep down you come to suspect that you're yourself to blame. And you stand naked and shivering before the millions of eyes who look through you unseeingly. That is the real soul sickness, the spear in the side, the drag by the neck through the mob-angry town, the grand inquisition, the embrace of the maiden, the rip in the belly with the guts spilling out, the trip to the chamber with the deadly gas that ends in the oven so hygienically clean, only it's worse because you continue stupidly to live. But live you must, and you can either make passive love to your sickness or burn it out and go on to the next conflicting phase. Yes, but what is the next phase? How often have I tried to find it? Over and over again I've gone up above to seek it out. For like almost everyone else in the country, I started out with my share of optimism. I believed in hard work and progress and action, but now, after first being for society and then against it, I assign myself no rank or any limit, and such an attitude is very much against the trend of the times. But my world has become one of infinite possibilities. What a phrase. Still, it's a good phrase and a good view of life, and a man shouldn't accept any other. That much I've learned underground. Until some gang succeeds in putting the world in a straitjacket, its definition is possibility. Step outside the narrow borders of what men call reality, and you step into chaos. Ask Reinhardt. He's a master of it. Or imagination. That, too, I've learned in the cellar. And not by deadening my sense of perception. I'm invisible. Not blind. No, indeed, the world is just as concrete, ornery, vile, and sublimely wonderful as before. Only now I better understand my relation to it and it to me. I've come a long way from those days when, full of illusion, I lived a public life and attempted to function under the assumption that the world was solid and all the relationships therein. Now I know men are different and that all life is divided and that only in division is their true health. Hence, again, I have stayed in my hole because up above there's an increasing passion to make men conform to a pattern. Just as in my nightmare, Jack and the boys are waiting with their knives, looking for the slightest excuse to, well, to
Ball the Jack, and I do not refer to the old dance step, although what they're doing is making the old eagle rock dangerously. Whence all this passion toward conformity, anyway? Diversity is the word. Let man keep his many parts, and you'll have no tyrant states. Why, if they follow this conformity business, they'll end up by forcing me, an invisible man, to become white, which is not a color, but the lack of one. Must I strive towards colorlessness? But seriously, and without snobbery, think of what the world would lose if that should happen. America is woven of many strands. I would recognize them and let it remain so. It's winner take nothing. That is the great truth of our country, or of any country. Life is to be lived, not controlled. And humanity is won by continuing to play in face of certain defeat. Our fate is to become one, and yet many. This is not prophecy, but a description. Thus, one of the greatest jokes in the world is the spectacle of the whites busy escaping blackness and becoming blacker every day, and the blacks striving toward whiteness becoming quite dull and gray. None of us seems to know who he is or where he's going. Which reminds me of something that occurred the other day in the subway. At first, I saw only an old gentleman who, for the moment, was lost. I knew he was lost, for as I looked down the platform, I saw him approach several people and turn away without speaking. He's lost, I thought, and he'll keep coming until he sees me. Then he'll ask his direction. Maybe there's an embarrassment in it if he admits he's lost to a strange white man. Perhaps to lose a sense of where you are implies the danger of losing a sense of who you are. That must be it, I thought. To lose your direction is to lose your face. So here he comes to ask his direction from the lost, the invisible. Very well. I've learned to live without direction. Let him ask. But then, he was only a few feet away and I recognized him. It was Mr. Norton. Ha! The old gentleman was thinner and wrinkled now, but as dapper as ever. And seeing him made all the old life live in me for an instant, and I smiled with tear-stinging eyes. Then it was over, dead. And when he asked me how to get to Center Street, I regarded him with mixed feelings. "Don't you know me?" I said. "Should I?" he said. "You see me?" I said, watching him tensely. "Why, of course. Sir, do you know the way to Center Street?" So, the last time it was the Golden Day, now it's Center Street. "You've retrenched, sir. But don't you really know who I am?" "Young man, I'm in a hurry," he said, cupping a hand to his ear. "Why should I know you? Because I'm your destiny." "My destiny, did you say?" He gave me a puzzled stare, backing away. "Young man, are you well? Which train did you say I should take?" "I didn't say," I said, shaking my head. "Now, aren't you ashamed?"
"Ashamed?"
"Ashamed?" he said indignantly. I laughed, suddenly taken by the idea. "Because, Mr. Norton, if you don't know where you are, you probably don't know who you are. So you come to me out of shame. You are ashamed now, aren't you?" "Young man, I've lived too long in this world to be ashamed of anything. Are you lightheaded from hunger? How do you know my name?" But I'm your destiny. I made you." "Why shouldn't I know?" I said, walking closer and seeing him back against a pillar. He looked around like a cornered animal. He thought I was mad. "Don't be afraid, Mr. Norton," I said. "There's a guard down the platform there. You're safe. Take any train. They all go to the Golden..." But now an express had rolled up, and the old man was disappearing quite spryly inside one of its doors. I stood there laughing hysterically. I laughed all the way back to my hole. But after I had laughed, I was thrown back on my thoughts. How had it all happened? And I asked myself if it were only a joke, and I couldn't answer. Since then, I've sometimes been overcome with a passion to return into the heart of darkness across the Mason-Dixon line, but then I remind myself that the true darkness lies within my own mind, and the idea loses itself in the gloom. still the passion, persists. Sometimes I feel the need to reaffirm all of it, the whole unhappy territory and all the things loved and unloved in it, for all of it is part of me. Till now, however, this is as far as I've ever gotten, for all life seen from the whole of invisibility is absurd. So why do I write torturing myself to put it down? Because in spite of myself, I've learned some things. Without the possibility of action, all knowledge comes to one labeled file and forget, and I can neither file nor forget. Nor will certain ideas forget me. They keep filing away at my lethargy, my complacency. Why should I be the one to dream this nightmare? Why should I be dedicated and set aside, yes, if not to at least tell a few people about it? There seems to be no escape. Here, I've set out to throw my anger into the world's face. But now that I've tried to put it all down, the old fascination with playing a role returns, and I'm drawn upward again, so that even before I finish, I've failed. Maybe my anger is too heavy, perhaps being a talker I've used too many words, but I've failed. The very act of trying to put it all down has confused me and negated some of the anger and some of the bitterness. So it is that now I denounce and defend, or feel prepared to defend. I condemn and affirm, say no and say yes and say no. I denounce because, though implicated and partially responsible, I have been hurt to the point of abysmal pain, hurt to the point of invisibility. And I defend because, in spite of all, I find that I love. In order to get some of it down, I have to love. I sell you no phony forgiveness. I'm a desperate man. But too much of your life will be lost. Its meaning lost, unless you approach it as much through love as through hate. So I approach it through division. So I denounce and defend, I hate and I love. Perhaps that makes me a little bit as human as my grandfather. Once I thought my grandfather incapable of thoughts about humanity, but I was wrong. Why should an old slave use such a phrase as, this and this, or this has made me more human, as I did in my arena speech? Hell, he never had any doubts about his humanity. That was left to his free offspring. He accepted his humanity just as he accepted the principle. It was his, and the principle lives on in all its human and absurd diversity. So now, having tried to put it down, I have disarmed myself in the process. You won't believe in my invisibility, and you'll fail to see how any principle that applies to you could apply to me. You'll fail to see it, even though death waits for both of us, if you don't. Nevertheless, the very disarmament has brought me to a decision. The hibernation is over. I must shake off the old skin and come up for breath. There's a stench in the air, which from this distance underground might be the smell either of death or of spring. I hope of spring. But don't let me trick you. There is a death in the smell of spring, and in the smell of thee as in the smell of me. And if nothing else more, invisibility has taught my nose to classify the stenches of death. In going underground, I whipped it all, except the mind. The mind. The mind that has conceived a plan of living must never lose sight of the chaos against which that pattern was conceived. That goes for societies as well as for individuals. Thus, having tried to give pattern to the chaos which lives within the pattern of your certainties, I must come out, I must emerge. And there's still a conflict within me. With Louis Armstrong, one half of me says, open the window and let the foul air out, while the other says, it was good green corn before the harvest. Of course, Louis was kidding. He wouldn't have thrown old bad air out, because it would have broken up the music and the dance, when it was the good music that came from the bell of old bad air's horn that counted. Old bad air is still around with his music and his dancing and his diversity, and I'll be up and around with mine. And as I said before, a decision has been made. I'm shaking off the old skin, and I'll leave it here in the hole. I'm coming out. No less invisible without it, but coming out nevertheless. And I suppose it's damn well time. Even hibernations can be overdone, come to think of it. Perhaps that's my greatest social crime. I've overstayed my hibernation, since there's a possibility that even an invisible man has a socially responsible role to play. Ah, I can hear you say. So it was all a build-up to bore us with his buggy jiving. He only wanted us to listen to him rave. But only partially true. Being invisible and without substance, a disembodied voice, as it were, what else could I do? What else but try to tell you what was really happening when your eyes were looking through? And it is this which frightens me. Who knows but that, on the lower frequencies, I speak for you.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison. Read for you by Joe Morton. This program was produced by Tara Meyer. Production supervisor, Lewis Milgram. Executive producer, Sherry Huber. Introduction copyright, 1994 by Charles Johnson. Biographical note copyright, 1992 by Random House, Inc. Text copyright, 1947, 1948, 1952 by Ralph Ellison. Text copyright renewed 1975, 1976, 1980 by Ralph Ellison. Production copyright 1999, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.